Chapter 4. Sulaco. Despite the less than encouraging news about the atmospheric properties of Fiorina, Fury 361, Chris was still determined to board the Sulaco in 2 hours. Ezra's sensor sweep of the ship gave him little reason for pause. The detailed examination results showed the Sulaco was precisely what she appeared at first sight. A ghost ship. Still, Chris could tell the security chief was not happy for his captain to traverse what Ezra considered an unknown. Fortunately, it wasn't Ezra's decision to make. It was his. Even though the Sulaco had remained in its own kind of suspended animation, trapped in orbit around Fiorina, the ship was not as dormant as it appeared. Despite most shipboard functions remaining inert, a few primary systems continued to operate thanks to the onboard mainframe. The autonomous systems functioned by using minimum power from the old-style fusion generators of the 21st century. According to Julia, with its inexhaustible energy supplies, the fusion reactor could have kept the Sulaco in place for another 400 years if they had not happened across its weak signal. Unfortunately, without the proper authorization codes, Alex and JD could not download the ship's logs without risking the data. As Chris suspected, the records for such codes did not survive the Third World War. Still, the data was recoverable. While they could not affect a download from ship to ship, a direct interface with the Sulaco's computer system and a portable tricorder would give them access. With JD's help, Alex activated the life support systems on board the ship, so by the time the away team finally arrived on the derelict vehicle, there would be an atmosphere to sustain them. Chris could not understand why he felt this need to immerse himself in the mystery of the Sulaco, but guessed it had to do with the problems he faced in his personal life at present. Perhaps a distraction was what he needed to regain his focus. Lord knows he was not making much progress now because those data pads had brought him to a brick wall he could not get past, despite devoting considerable time and energy to the endeavor. For the moment anyway, Chris wanted a problem he could solve.
"Sure I can't talk you out of this?"
Buck asked Chris as he and the away team prepared to transport to the Sulaco once all the precautions, at least the ones able to be taken in the meager time Chris gave them before his intended departure. Although the Sulaco seemed safe, Buck could not shake the feeling of potential danger. It was why he opted to remain on the Maverick. In case something went wrong, he could utilize the ship's resources to retrieve his crewmates.
"Isn't it enough you've got both Ezra and Alex coming along to nursemaid me?"
Buck tensed, aware Chris was being antagonistic, but reminded himself Chris was his friend and captain, even if the man was being an unmitigated pain at the moment. Besides, Buck was confident Chris's annoyance had much to do with the fact that, on some level, he knew Buck was right to be cautious.
"You're the captain of this ship."
Buck struggled to maintain his good-natured disposition.
"I would not be doing my job if I let you go into a questionable situation without taking adequate safety precautions. Alex is the science officer. Next to Julia, she's probably the most qualified person to go on this mission."
"And the fact Alex has some security training has nothing to do with it?"
"None whatsoever."
Buck lied through his teeth. Chris's disbelief was plain as he stepped onto the transporter pad where the rest of his crew were waiting for him. Buck said nothing as he drew away, and Chris knew his old friend was seething under the skin. A twinge of guilt ran through the captain when Buck stood next to Rain at the transporter controls. Nothing Buck demanded of him since he decided to board the Sulaco himself was unreasonable. It was the duty of the first officer to safeguard the captain's life, even if that same captain was behaving contrary to good sense. Wisely, the others feigned ignorance at the exchange, busying themselves with the last-minute checks before an away mission. No one wanted to meet his gaze except Wynn, who did not look at him reproachfully. This was hardly surprising. From the onset, Wynn was the only person on board who did not feel it necessary to tell Chris what he ought to do and who he was neglecting. Wynn did not inundate him with advice, and for that, Chris was grateful. He wished everyone else would follow the helmsman's lead. Ezra examined the phaser rifle in his grip, ensuring it was ready for use if the situation arose. While Chris considered the gun excessive for a simple exploratory mission, Ezra refused to be deterred. Chris conceded the point since Ezra's nose for trouble was often accurate. Despite his insistence on boarding the Sulaco, the safety of his people allowed Chris to make the compromise. Every member of the away team carried a phaser, and while Julia did not hide her eagerness to go, Alex, like Ezra, seemed tense.
"Are we ready?"
Chris asked no one in particular, but received a chorus of responses
in affirmative.
Obtaining the answers he wanted, he raised his eyes to Buck, who seemed clearly troubled. Once again, his regret at their fractured relationship gnawed at him.
"Hey Buck,"
Chris said in a conciliatory effort he hoped his old friend understood.
"I'll be careful."
Buck reacted with surprise at the gesture, and for the first time in days, the first officer cracked the familiar smile that told Chris all was forgiven if not forgotten.
"I'll hold you to that, Captain.
You can count on it."
For that moment, at least, their enmity vanished. Chris remembered the old friend who stood by him and made sure he did not go to pieces when he first lost his family, riding out the storm to help him. It was no different this time. No matter what, Chris could always count on Buck to watch his back and to ensure he never gave up on anything, even himself. It was a good feeling. Delaying no more with such introspective thoughts, Chris decided it was time to go and regarded the transporter chief awaiting his order.
"Engage."
It was cold when they materialized on the Sulaco's main hangar bay deck. This, of course, was hardly surprising since the ship had been devoid of warmth for the past 400 years. While its life support systems were fully operational, it would take some time before the onboard environment became completely comfortable for its human visitors. After all, warming up 4 centuries of cold was not a straightforward task, with the limitations of the technology at hand. The iciness reminded them they had arrived at their destination intact, even if the pinch of cold on their skin was far from pleasant. Internal sensors detected movement in the area and immediately kicked into action, programmed by engineers who were long dead. Lights flooded the hangar bay, illuminating every corner of the expansive deck. When they had seen the Sulaco from the bridge of the Maverick, they already knew the transport carrier was a large ship, even by modern standards. However, nowhere was that scale more apparent than from the interior of the hangar bay. The Maverick's shuttle bay looked cramped in comparison. They materialized in front of the main hangar doors, a massive construct forged of solid titanium and would give any craft entering without authorization good reason to regret it. It did not take them long to realize the reason for the doors was the dark gray ship hanging suspended above the deck by large clamps on a mobile conveyor. This meant the conveyor could transport the craft across the deck to a secondary set of doors, large enough for the vessel to pass when clamps were released.
"Something happened here."
Chris broke the silence.
"I see it."
Ezra nodded in agreement. The security officer studied their surroundings as intensely as Chris. 400 years ago, something occurred inside this hangar. Objects from small tools to large crates were scattered across the floor. There were 2 sets of docking clamps, but only 1 ship was visible. Large gaping holes appeared in the floor where floor plates should have been, exposing maintenance conduits and electrical access tunnels. The disarray seemed to center around the airlock doors.
"Someone decompressed the hangar,"
Chris stated.
"Why?"
Julia mused.
"I don't know,"
Chris responded, his voice tensing considerably as he searched the space for more clues to what had happened here. Suddenly, the need for answers became more urgent, and Chris wondered if Buck had not been right after all. That coming here without all the facts had been reckless.
"Alex, you and Julia go find the bridge. We need that log."
"Yes, sir."
Alex gestured for Julia to follow. Despite the possibility of danger, Julia was still enthusiastic about taking a tour of the ship, and Chris hoped her eagerness did not make her careless and miss something important. Fortunately, Alex would maintain an objective view of their situation. They progressed across the steel deck, sidestepping the mess left behind by the decompression of the landing bay to approach a set of smaller doors at the far end of the room. Chris watched them long enough to see them disappear into the lit corridor. Once they were gone, Chris tapped his comm badge.
"Larrabee to Maverick."
"Chris."
Buck's voice filled the room a second later.
"What's your status?"
"We're here, and we're fine for the moment. However, there have been signs of trouble on board."
"What kind of trouble?"
"We haven't determined that yet,"
Chris said, seeing Wynn and Ezra spreading out across the deck.
"But the crew found it necessary to decompress the landing bay. Judging by the debris scattered around the place, rather suddenly too."
"Perhaps you should get back here."
"No."
Chris shook his head, but he was now more considerate of Buck's concerns.
"However, maintain a transporter lock on all of us until I say otherwise. If something goes wrong, I want a quick way out. Understood?"
"Yes, Captain. Mind keeping an open channel?"
"Sure. I'm not taking any chances until I know what happened here."
"Thank you, Captain."
Buck said gratefully, glad Chris was finally seeing some sense. Chris noted what Ezra and Wynn were doing and saw the Vulcan making a beeline towards the dropship. This did not surprise the captain in the least. The helmsman's eyes lit up the moment he cast his gaze on the armored carrier, and Chris could tell the young man was itching to get a closer look at the vintage piece of machinery. Wynn had a fascination for all kinds of aircraft. The older, the better. One of his hobbies was building models, and Chris supposed a dropship from the 21st century would qualify as a find for a connoisseur. However, Chris was more interested in what Ezra was doing and crossed the floor to join the security chief, kneeling down on the landing deck, examining a section of floor with intense scrutiny. If there was one thing Chris knew never to do, no matter how obstinate he may get about his personal demons, it was never underestimating Ezra Standish's skills as an investigator. If he were not so hellbent on solving this problem of Sarah and Adam on his own, he might have even employed the security chief for that very purpose. Perhaps what made Ezra such an exceptional card player was his ability to see through the obvious, finding subtle and often obscure clues.
What have you found, Ezra?
Chris reached the security chief, running a tricorder over what he had found. From Chris's experience, Ezra only used the tricorder to confirm his visual findings. The chief often stated that reliance on technology could hinder the deductive reasoning of an investigator.
Acid burns,
Ezra spoke, not looking up at Chris. His fingers traced the grooves against the corroded metal floor. As Chris examined it, he could see why Ezra was so interested. It was a good 3 inches in depth, and though time had cooled the metal where it was eaten away, there was no doubt the reaction had been extremely severe.
Acid did this?
Chris stared at Ezra with shock. The corroded floor was constructed with solid titanium. It had to be because it was the landing bay where the Sulaco's dropship had to set down. These days, it would require a phaser to burn through this.
The like of which I have never seen before. This is easily the most corrosive variety in existence. Raw plasma is the closest comparison I can imagine. Furthermore, it is molecular, which implies a biological source.
Are you telling me this acid came from a life form?
Chris balked, unable to imagine what kind of creature would have acid as a part of its biological secretions.
That's not possible. No carbon-based life form can produce molecular acid.
Assuming, of course, we are dealing with a carbon-based life form.
Silicon-based?
Chris looked at his security chief, venturing a guess. The universal standard for the basis of all life was carbon. On rare occasions, nature felt the need to throw a curveball at them by producing a life form whose matrix was composed of some other material. The Hordas, discovered in a mining facility by the USS Enterprise under James Kirk's command, proved silicon-based creatures' existence. Some years later, Jean-Luc Picard's Enterprise found a life form based on phosphorus that almost took over Enterprise D.
Possibly.
Ezra studied the hangar bay and deduced what had transpired here with a flash of insight. Staring at the airlock, the pieces before him formed a picture of what happened here. When Ezra turned to Chris, his expression was stony.
What concerns me, Captain, is why someone found it necessary to blow it out of the airlock.
Such questions concerned neither Julia Pemberton nor Alexandra Stiles because the task before them was simple enough. Julia found the technical data regarding the transport carriers of the 21st century in the Maverick's main computer, allowing her and Alex to navigate the ship well enough to find the bridge of the Sulaco. The engineer moved through the silent corridors like a child in a candy store, admiring the old wiring and the welded steel plates, amusing herself at the finished joints of the walls. Alex shared Julia's enthusiasm to a degree, but she experienced a growing feeling of unease moving through the deserted paths of the ship. The signal they deciphered from the Sulaco spoke of 3 humans on board. Yet everything Alex came across indicated otherwise. That question hung in the air like a meteor about to drop. As they sought the bridge, they came across communal showers and mess halls made to accommodate more people. Then there were the lockers. Opening them, Alex and Julia discovered 14 lockers were occupied. 14 occupied lockers meant 14 crew members. Not 3. Alex stared at the red bandana in her hand, the one she liberated from the locker belonging to a PFC Vasquez, and wondered what had happened to the woman. Although the garments inside were terribly asexual, there were pieces of femininity tucked away amongst the military-issued items. A bottle of skin cream whose contents were desiccated by now and soft, lacy underthings tucked away beneath khaki boxers as if Vasquez was attempting to hide them. Alex did not know why she kept the bandana when they left the locker room filled with belongings that would never be claimed. Illogically, Alex felt obligated to Vasquez to learn what happened here. The bridge was nothing like what Alex considered one should be, not when compared to the Maverick. Only two people would fit the cramped confines with machinery pressing in, no matter where they turned. Most of the panels were dark and inert, with a few blinking lights to show the ship was still functioning. Once Julia activated the dormant systems, the bridge took on a life of its own at the detection of a human operator. Screen and panels came alive and consoles, though somewhat cool to the touch, waited eagerly for human interaction once again after spending four centuries in frozen inertia.
It might be an idea for us to go after what we need slowly,
Julia advised when she sat before a terminal.
It's been 400 years. I'd like not to overload its operating system and have burnout. God help us if it's still using that antiquated Windows system.
That's not funny.
Who's joking? I'd recommend we work our way through the data banks. We should gradually progress through the data stream before attempting to access the ship's logs. These old systems devoted considerable resources to passwords and security lockouts, so I want to take it easy. If it handles the simple commands without difficulty, we'll attempt to interface the primary data banks with the tricorder.
Agreed.
Alex took the seat next to Julia.
Okay, something simple. How about a crew manifest?
Crew manifest.
Julia mused as her fingers started flying over the keyboard, and Alex watched the screen come alive as Julia entered the request for information. Words flew across the digital screen before a short, abrupt beep signaled access. A list of names appeared before them. As Alex suspected, there had been 14 people on board the Sulaco when she left Earth. Out of those, two were civilians, and the others were military personnel.
You want a display?
Julia looked over her shoulder at the science officer.
Yes, let's have a look at them.
The commanding officer was not at all impressive, or perhaps it was the image that made him look that way. He was a poster boy recruit of the ideal soldier of that period, clean-cut and somewhat dull-looking. There was little or no intelligence about him, and he did not look seasoned. His rank had him placed as a lieutenant.
Says here, his name is Lieutenant R.C. Gorman. Christ, he's just a kid. What's he doing in charge?
Who knows?
Alex shrugged, more interested in seeing the image of PFC Vasquez than some fresh-faced kid who probably got more people killed by being put in command too soon than their enemies.
Who's next?
Moving along.
Julia brought the cursor down to illuminate the next name on the list. Alex shuddered as the faces appeared before her, wondering whether it was the cold or the knowledge they were all dead. Something happened to them to ensure they never returned to the Sulaco. The next face to appear was a man with granite features. He was in his 40s, Alex estimated, a combat veteran through and through. He had the visage of a mean junkyard dog, and she did not doubt he'd give a Klingon a run for his money if faced with one.
Master Sergeant Apon. And boy, does he look it.
Give him a bathlet and run for cover. Damn, I hate to meet what took him out.
Despite herself, Alex's statement was not a joke. She looked into the screen at the man's hard eyes and knew he was someone who did not frighten easily. He could bellow his platoon into submission and was probably the glue holding the entire unit together. Such men usually made up for the shortcomings of their inexperienced commanders. Alex served with such soldiers during the border wars and met Bajoran freedom fighters with the same steel. Whatever killed this man was something they had all better fear.
I'm going to keep going.
Julia highlighted the next name on the list. Senior Corporal D. Hicks. She pressed the enter button on the old keyboard and froze when his face appeared on the screen.
Oh my god.
Alex exclaimed, unaware she'd gasped out loud.
Holy shit. It's impossible.
Alex did not answer. While similarly stunned, she had the presence of mind enough to tap her comm badge.
Captain.
Alex.
Chris Larrabee's voice responded.
What is it? Did you access the ship's logs?
Alex paused a moment, wondering how to answer before deciding the best way to do this was to show him.
Captain, I think you'd better come and see this for yourself.
Chapter 5. Ripley. Buck Wilmington stared at the viewscreen before him and decided he did not like this ship called the Sulaco. Everything about the vessel suspended in the canvas of blue told him it was a secret best left unexplained. Letting his eyes run across the dark metal shell of the ship, Buck felt a sense of foreboding building up in his chest regarding the Sulaco, even though, for all intents and purposes, there was nothing outwardly threatening about it. The Sulaco was a troop carrier with primitive armaments that were no danger to the Maverick, with its torpedo bays, shields, and phaser banks. Yet as he studied the ship, he could not help but feel a sliver of unease. Chris and the away team were still conducting preliminary investigations of the carrier. So far, everything they learned gave Buck more and more reason to think perhaps they just ought to get a science vessel out here to deal with the ancient relic. Still, the enthusiasm in Chris's voice, despite the captain's caution, could not be mistaken. Buck had not heard Chris sound so interested in anything other than Sarah and Adam's murder in weeks. He supposed the Sulaco was about as tantalizing as any mystery could be. A ship from Earth's past, shrouded in mystery, was just the thing Chris needed right now. When Mary Travis stepped onto the bridge, his attention shifted from the viewscreen to the turbo lift doors. It was the first time he'd seen her since they passed each other in the doorway of Chris's ready room, where she requested a leave of absence. It was good to see her on the bridge again because she was a vital member of the senior staff. Mary's insight as a negotiator, diplomat, and knowledge of alien cultures made her a valuable asset. Though she was not always needed on the bridge, Buck still liked seeing her there.
Are they still over there?
Mary asked, taking her usual seat next to the captain's command chair.
Yeah, I think they're going to be there a while. Chris is pretty intrigued.
Mary nodded slightly as if the mention of Chris suddenly surfaced their personal problems, making the emotions churning inside her even more difficult to hide.
You okay?
He asked softly, placing a gentle hand on her arm. Mary met his gaze and nodded again.
Yes, I am. I think the time apart might do us both some good. We've been living on the same ship for the last few months. Perhaps we need a step back to gain some perspective on things.
Buck did not think it would help, but he did not voice it.
Mary,
he considered what he would say and decided if Buck was told to mind his own business, at least he got it off his chest.
Don't give up on him. I know he's behaving like a prized ass, but don't give up on him. He loves you, but sometimes when he gets his mind set on something, he can't let it go, no matter how much he may want to. Trust me, I've seen this before, and the best thing you can do is to ride it out.
Mary offered Buck a warm smile, wondering if Chris knew how lucky he was to have someone like Buck Wilmington in his corner. Buck was loyal to the last and knew people much more than anyone gave him credit. Some men had the market cornered on strategy and intuition, but Buck's fortune seemed to be made in knowing how to look at someone and recognizing instantly what they felt and needed. It was a wonderful gift, and not enough people appreciated it.
Thank you, Buck.
Mary answered, sincere in her gratitude and touched deeply by his plea.
I don't intend to give up on him, but I think perhaps I need to wait him out somewhere else.
Buck nodded in understanding, wishing it was otherwise, but perhaps it was what Chris needed. Maybe he needed to lose her to know how much she meant to him. Since Mary came on board, she and Chris shared a smoldering relationship, though not physical, was nevertheless passionate.
Commander, I'm getting an incoming transmission from Starfleet Command. It's on a standard channel.
The young communications officer volunteered, guessing it was probably a routine business that did not require encryption.
Transfer it to the captain's ready room. I'll take it in there.
Aye, sir.
JD nodded and returned to the console before him to carry out the order. Buck excused himself and headed towards the captain's ready room. Upon entering its confines, he slid into the captain's chair and swung around to face the comm screen on the wall. Incoming message blinked on the dark screen.
Computer, open channel.
The image of Admiral Donaldson appeared on the screen a moment later. Buck knew Donaldson from the few times they encountered each other over the years. While Buck could not say he knew the man terribly well, Donaldson was an amicable fellow attached to the diplomatic arm of Starfleet operation. He smiled upon seeing Buck, having dealt more with the first officer than he did with the captain of the Maverick, and appeared pleased to see someone he knew.
Buck,
Donaldson greeted.
It's been a long time.
A year.
Buck returned his greeting with similar warmth.
How's Mars these days?
Still hot and dry,
Donaldson responded, more than happy to indulge in a little small talk, which told Buck whatever reason he had contacted the Maverick was not terribly urgent.
And the frontier?
Quiet for the moment, though that may change any time. There's always something going on out here that usually finds its way to us.
I was hoping to speak to your captain, but I gather he's indisposed.
Yes, sir.
Buck was not about to lie.
We've discovered a derelict ship that might have been from Earth. So far, we estimate it's almost 400 years old. The captain is investigating it right now.
The discovery piqued Donaldson's curiosity, and it showed across his face.
Really? I wouldn't mind looking at her myself. Unfortunately, I will have to tear your ship away from an exciting find.
I guessed as much,
Buck remarked, and suddenly the casual note in his voice withered away, replaced with a more businesslike and official tone.
What can the Maverick do for you, sir?
It's nothing high risk,
Donaldson answered quickly, taking on the same tone as Buck.
I need the Maverick at Sector 29, in the Vorlis system. We are presently negotiating their entry into the Federation, but apparently, one of their outer colonies has suffered an ecological disaster. They have the personnel and the equipment to take care of the problem, but they need a ship with maximum warp capability to get there. As a gesture of goodwill, I've offered Federation help in this matter to let them know we'd pull out all stops to help if the situation called for it. The entire mission will take 4 days, 5 at the most round trip, so your derelict will still be there when you get back.
He was right. It was routine and not uncommon for starships to be used this way when courting a new entry into the Federation.
I'll inform the captain. We'll see you soon.
Thank you, Buck.
Donaldson smiled.
I'll buy you a drink when you get here.
I'll hold you to that.
The first officer said before ending the transmission. Buck leaned back into the chair and let out a deep sigh. While he did not resent the mission ahead, he wished it could have come at another time. The Sulaco was just the thing Chris needed right now. He hated to think this trip to Forli would send the captain back into his obsession about the accident. Unfortunately, there was no avoiding it. Their duty to Starfleet came first, and that meant abandoning the Sulaco. Still, Buck did not relish having to recall the captain. He had a feeling that Chris would not take it well this time.
Jesus!
When Tanner whispered under his breath as he stared at the screen displaying Julia and Alex's discovery in the Sulaco's memory banks. The face on the screen was, without doubt, the spitting image of Chris Larrabee. The hair was different, and the face was definitely younger, but those who knew the captain well marveled at the resemblance.
He looks exactly like you.
Corporal Dwayne Hicks.
Ezra read the data on the screen while standing next to Chris, who stared at the image with an unreadable expression.
At the time of his arrival on the Sulaco, it would appear he was 25.
Chris was still gripped with astonishment. He knew he had an ancestor in this period, perhaps not directly connected to the Larrabee line. Still, time had a way of twisting the lineages with such complexity it was hard to say where the genetic branches would end up. A few hours ago, he spoke of a distant relation who was a colonial marine in the 21st century and thought no more of it. Now, seeing the man before him, Chris wondered if there was some sort of serendipity at work here, making him the one to discover this ship that had once ferried someone from his own distant past. Hicks wore his face, although the image portrayed him as a man just a little younger than Wynn. The eyes, of course, were always the same on the Larrabee men, but there was something in Hicks's eyes that told Chris the corporal had seen much in his brief life. The short excerpt next to his image almost served as an epitaph of who Dwayne Hicks had been. What forces shaped his life to put the same look of premature age in his eyes? Did he suffer the same sorrows? Chris hated to think someone so young could have become so used to his mortality. Chris found his voice at last.
I had a distant relative in the Colonial Marines. I guess this is him.
No kidding. I can't believe the resemblance.
Alex leaned closer as if she needed another look to confirm what her mind had trouble accepting.
So, do we have some idea of what happened to these people?
Chris asked, dismissing the subject of Hicks for the moment. He was still shocked by all of it and preferred to move on since this could not be more than a coincidence. Chris doubted his relationship with Hicks had anything to do with why the Sulaco was stranded above Fiorina.
Well, I opened the log.
Julia answered quickly, aware despite this compelling turn of events with his ancestor, the captain would be more interested in learning why the Sulaco was here.
Alex. Right.
Alex nodded, having reviewed the information while awaiting the arrival of the others.
According to the logs, Earth sent the Sulaco to check on a mining colony on planet LV-427, called Acheron. Apparently, the colony was out of contact for almost 3 months and as per standard procedure, they dispatched an investigating team to see what happened.
And they sent a fully armored military vessel with a platoon of colonial marines?
Ezra found the action somewhat extreme for what could simply be a malfunctioning transmitter. Even a medical rescue ship made more sense than sending the troops in.
That seems somewhat unusual.
It is.
Chris agreed and prompted Alex to continue.
According to the log, there was a concern about a biological threat on LV-427. A report from a warrant officer Ellen Ripley from a year earlier indicated there was an unknown life form on the planet that might be a danger to the colonists. Now there is information regarding the organism attached to the log, but it's encrypted. Julia is trying to get through the decryption codes without corrupting the data. Whatever this thing was, it was considered highly classified. Perhaps too classified for the Weyland-Yutani Corporation, who owned the mining operations on LV-427, to omit the information from the colonists.
There was a dangerous organism on the planet, and no one even bothered to tell the people living there?
Wynn's disgust was plain.
The Weyland-Yutani Corporation was infamous for such practices, Lieutenant. One would say they had an almost Ferengi approach to commerce.
So they went to the colony and found it?
Chris urged her to go on, wanting to know the rest.
That's as far as the official log goes, sir. The Sulaco arrived at Acheron with Ellen Ripley attached to the mission as a consultant. It fell into standard orbit around the planet, at which time the ship revived everyone from cryosleep. With the continuing radio silence, the only way to determine the status of the colony was to make a surface landing. Lieutenant Gorman, the officer in charge, makes the last log entry, in which he reports the entire crew preparing to depart from the Sulaco on board one of the dropships.
And that is all?
Ezra asked, hoping there would be more, particularly about this life form found on LV-427.
Not quite.
Julia spoke up, giving her lover a little wink as she did so.
I'm reading a lot of information coming through to the Sulaco after their departure. I'm assuming these were recordings from the squad while on the surface, probably from personnel recorders.
That makes sense.
Chris agreed.
Most of the military were required to wear such devices during that period, mostly to monitor performance in the field and record how they conducted themselves for future reference. Can we access those?
Yes, we can.
Julia said distractedly because she was concentrating on accessing Ellen Ripley's report without its redactions. She suspected the report had the answers the captain wanted about the fate of the Sulaco and its crew.
However, we'll get a lot of information from varying angles, depending on the perspective of the person wearing the camera.
Julia continued her assault on the encryption guarding Ripley's report until finally, it unlocked with an abrupt burst of static.
I think you'll find this of more interest, Captain.
The image of a woman appeared through the white noise of the screen. It was a face of quiet dignity. Her patrician features made her handsome more than beautiful, but there was something about the eyes that touched Chris Larrabee profoundly. She wore her dark red hair short, and Chris sensed there was a time when she would have worn it over her shoulders, though it would have appeared fuller. She wore no makeup and stared back at her audience with the eyes of someone whose soul clung to life by a thread. As if the very idea of living was so elusive, she walked in perpetual readiness to die. Then she spoke. It was a sad voice, a voice so hard done by life he could not imagine her using it to laugh or express any of the more joyful emotions. Where she lived was a place he knew all too well, mired by so much pain it was impossible to feel anything else.
My name is Ellen Ripley, formerly Warrant Officer Ripley. Burke wants me to make this tape for you Marines to get a fair idea of what you may deal with on LV-427.
She paused a moment, unaware her audience from 400 years in the future hung on her every word.
I can't do this without a cigarette.
Her hand vanished from the view of the grainy screen to produce a stick of white recognized by those present as a cigarette, a vice long forgotten by history. After lighting the stalk in her mouth, she took a deep breath and blew rings of smoke into the air. Chris suspected Ripley was clearly delaying what was required of her until finally, she forced away her anxiety to face the camera, filled with new resolve.
I don't know how much they briefed you or what I'm supposed to tell you, so I'll just start from the beginning. I was the second officer of the commercial carrier Nostromo. We were on our way home to Earth with a full cargo of ore from the Rim when we were revived from cryosleep by the ship's computer. There were seven of us. Dallas, Kane, Ash, Lambert, Parker, Brett, and myself. Oh, of course, there was Jones, but he was Brett's cat, so I guess he didn't really count.
None of the Mavericks spoke because there was something in how Ripley told her tale that demanded silence and respect, even from 400 years in the past. Chris could not stop looking at her. What path had her life taken? Had it begun with the Nostromo, or were there previous sorrows contributing to what she became? Chris pondered this briefly and then put the idea away because he wanted to hear her story.
When we woke up, we were nowhere home.
Ripley resumed her narrative, breathing more smoke from her slowly depleting cigarette.
The ship's computer woke us early because it detected a signal of unknown origin, and we were bound by our company contracts to investigate.
Ripley's eyes drifted away a second as she saw something only she could see before clearing her throat to resume speaking, her voice becoming hard.
The signal source came from LV-427, an uninhabited and previously unsurveyed planet.
The content of the signal was odd, so while Captain Dallas, First Officer Kane, and Lambert went to find the source, which was some 1,500 meters from our landing site, I examined the message.
She paused again. This time, her jaw clenched as if she needed to compose herself before she resumed speaking.
I discovered the message was not a distress beacon as we thought, but a warning. I wanted to go after Captain Dallas and tell him what I found, but Ash, our science officer, told me it was pointless. By the time I reached the others, they would have already found out what was at the source. Foolishly, I listened to him.
I can't imagine a science officer offering that advice.
As one herself, Alex knew how important it was to have accurate information when wandering into a strange situation.
We soon found the source of the signal was a derelict spaceship of unknown origin. It was not a large clunker like we have, but something with smooth lines and curves. Obviously, they were from a highly advanced species, but they were still no match for their cargo. Kane, Dallas, and Lambert entered that ship and discovered its dead pilot. We never knew exactly how long he'd been there, but by the fossilization of his remains, it must have been hundreds of years. However, his sternum had erupted from the inside. Dallas assumed, because of the ship's age, there was no danger. So the ground team pressed on until they found the cargo hold.
She paused again. Chris sensed Ripley was finally nearing the most painful part of her tale. He would have reached for her hand if she had been present, but of course, that was impossible. Ripley was long gone, and those sad eyes with her.
There were eggs, a foot tall, translucent with spores inside them. Kane, who went into the hold, said he saw thousands of them. We never really knew for sure, because it appeared whatever was inside them was still alive. Once the eggs detected life, they unsealed. Upon emergence, the spore attached itself to Kane's face. It burned through the plastic of his visor to reach his skin. By the time Dallas and Lambert got to him, it was too late for Kane. Of course, we didn't know that yet. We got him back to the ship so we could get it off him.
Ripley took a breath and resumed speaking after discarding her cigarette, now burnt back to the filter.
As soon as we cut it, the alien bled molecular acid. A drop of it ate through three levels of the Nostromo before it finally stopped. We couldn't take it off without killing Kane, so Dallas decided to freeze him and let ICU quarantine deal with him on Earth. However, before we could do that, the spore dislodged itself from Kane and died. Kane woke up fine. He was a little hungry, but lucid and physically recovered.
Ripley lit another cigarette, and Chris noted her hands were shaking this time. Her expression seemed fearful, and her skin had become pale.
We were in the middle of dinner when Kane started convulsing. We thought he might have been choking on something, but soon he was screaming. Then we saw the blood. The spore laid some kind of embryo inside his throat. After gestation, the newborn exited through the sternum.
Christ!
Wynn exclaimed, visibly shaken to his Vulcan core. Ezra, who was always so practiced at hiding his emotions, was just as horrified. Alex tried to find precedents for such a life cycle and found the closest thing to be how spiders laid their eggs on a host animal for the newborn to feed upon emergence. Julia's hand covered her mouth. Chris could only feel empathy, understanding now the reason for Ripley's haunted eyes.
Once the alien emerged, it matured quickly. In the space of 24 hours, Captain Dallas and the rest of the crew were dead. We received no help from our science officer before that, but there was a good reason for it. I learned that the company had diverted us to LV-427, specifically to get the alien, that we were expendable as long as they brought the alien back to Earth. Our science officer was a goddamn synthetic, and he sacrificed the others to make sure it got back to the company. Can you believe that?
While it appalled everyone present, the callous practices of the multinationals like Weyland Yudani were historical facts. Eventually, they contributed to the rise of global fascism and the outbreak of the Third World War.
I set the Nostromo for self-destruct after the others were gone and abandoned ship. No one else got off the Nostromo, and I took my chances in the life pod. I hoped to be picked up when I approached the core worlds, but that didn't happen. I woke up, can you believe it? 57 years after I blew up the Nostromo and the alien.my 11-year-old daughter had died by the time I got back to Earth.
For a moment, the lady went very silent, and the sadness on her face was so profound it touched everyone watching her silently in the confines of the Sulaco's small bridge. Ripley composed herself for a few seconds and then raised her eyes to the camera once more, the same resolve on her face.
When I got back, they didn't believe me. There was no corroborating evidence there was ever a life form, so they blamed me for destroying the Nostromo, a rather expensive piece of hardware, as one of those corporate assholes put it. They didn't believe me even though LV-427 was now populated with a colony of at least 80 to 90 families. They didn't believe me even though I told them Kane saw thousands of eggs, capable of producing thousands of those things like the one that wiped out my entire crew in a day.
Ripley fell silent, blinking away her bitterness before she spoke again.
Now you Marines are supposed to clean up the mess. If those colonists have found that ship and exposed those eggs, all of them could be potential hosts. These things are beyond vicious. They move fast, and they're strong. Most of the time, the alien attacked before we knew what hit us. Ash said they had no morality, no conscience. He's right. They have one purpose, and that is to breed. When I left the Nostromo, I found what I was pretty damn sure was its nest. It was using Dallas as a host. I hope to God I'm wrong. I hope to God when we go down to that planet, we'll find all that's wrong is a down transmitter, because the alternative is a hell you can't imagine.
Jesus, I really want to be wrong.
But she was not. Even though none of the Maverick officers had viewed the rest of the data in the Sulaco's memory banks, they knew that everything Ellen Ripley predicted had occurred and more. Much, much more. Chapter 7. Interruptions. There was silence after Ellen Ripley's commentary concluded, stretching over several minutes. The lady's story was macabre, not so much in encountering a dangerous life form because one could not feel entirely overawed by that aspect of it when one had been in Starfleet. For 100 years of charting the unexplored regions of space taught humans one thing above all else, it was dangerous out here. For every spectacular experience filling the soul with notions of cosmic beauty, there was a dark side that reminded one most starkly the unknown was not always safe. For the crew of the Nostromo, it had been damning. However, the terrors of space were no match for the evils of greed, and those who lusted for it so badly they would sacrifice innocence to possess it. Chris and his senior staff were well aware of the atrocities committed by the multinationals of the 21st century. History deemed them as foul a villain as the Third Reich and the Inquisition, but to hear it firsthand, to listen to a tale that was more than pages in a history book, made it seem so much worse. After the report returned to static, it took a few minutes for someone to speak. Predictably, it was Ezra, who was never at a loss for words, although Chris could see Ripley's story appalled him too. As the security chief, his first duty was to protect everyone under his care. The utter disregard for life displayed by the Weyland Yudani Corporation was an affront to Ezra.
I am assuming by the message we intercepted on the Maverick from this vessel, it would appear only 3 people made it off LV-427 alive.
Ezra leaned against the nearby wall, trying to dispel the pointless anger he felt. The events provoking his outrage were 400 years in the past. Still, he felt incensed by what happened to Ripley and those unfortunate enough to be caught in the corporation's web of deceit.
It would appear so,
Alex responded, recounting the content of the message they intercepted.
Hicks made it out and so did Ripley. I can't imagine how they would have found a juvenile alive, but it's safe to assume she was probably from the colony.
How can that be?
Julia questioned.
If the colony was infested,
How could a child have survived long enough for a rescue ship to arrive? I mean, it took months, literally months, for ships to cross interstellar space. That would mean she had to avoid the creatures all that time.
It's not impossible.
Wynn felt compelled to speak up for the child in question. A crash marooned Wynn on a savage planet where the odds of survival were slim. Yet he did so, even though the foster parents with him had not survived to be rescued.
Children are a lot smarter than we give them credit for. Push comes to shove. She might have learned how to get around them.
This is all academic.
Chris interrupted.
The fact of the matter is these people are dead, and 400 years ago there was some kind of failure which caused Ripley and the rest of the survivors to be ejected to the surface of Fury 361. Whatever threat the life form may have posed is no longer on board this ship. Most likely, it's still on LV-427.
I am not so certain of that, Captain.
Ezra countered, not that easily convinced.
The evidence in the hangar shows at least one of those creatures made it on board the Sulaco.
You're kidding.
Alex exclaimed, her scientific curiosity piqued because she would love to examine a specimen like this in the postmortem. Ripley's description convinced Alex anyone running into one of these creatures alive would not survive the experience.
How can you tell?
Acid burns on the deck.
Chris recalled Ezra's discovery.
We found evidence of molecular acid having eaten through the floor plating, but it also looks like the survivors decompressed the landing bay to get it off the ship. I don't imagine they would have climbed into stasis with it running around loose.
I'd like to get a look at the planet.
Alex looked to Chris because she felt the captain was more than intrigued by the notion of his ancestor being directly involved in these events.
I'd like to fly that dropship,
Wynn said with a grin.
You must be joking.
Ezra gaped at the helmsman with distaste.
That dropship, as you call it, has been sitting inactive for the past 400 years. You do not know if it will even fly.
Oh, I don't know.
Julia countered, thinking about it seriously now.
It might need a diagnostic and a few little repairs, but there's no reason it would be inoperative. After all, the ship has been devoid of an atmosphere for the duration of its orbit here. There would be minimal degradation.
Secretly, Julia would love to see if the smaller ship could fly. In fact, she would do the maintenance just to allow Wynn to take it out.
You are both mad,
Ezra said sweetly.
Alex,
Chris turned to the science officer.
Do you think you can go through all the transmissions from the personal recorders and put them in some kind of coherent order?
I believe so.
Alex nodded, prepared to do it even if the captain hadn't asked.
I'll get started right away.
Good. Julia, you can give the dropship a once-over.
The captain gave Wynn a little smile of indulgence.
All right.
Wynn grinned with boyish excitement, terribly out of place on his Vulcan features, as he turned to Julia.
Come on, I'll help you.
Don't you just love him?
Alex gave the redhead a playful wink.
In the meantime, I'll get started on the data. Captain, what are you and Ezra going to do?
Chris considered the question for a moment.
We'll take another look around the ship. I don't think we have any more visitors on board, but I'd like to know what caused that electrical fire.
So would I. Even in this period, the safeguards to protect those in cryosleep were extensive. I find it unimaginable all those contingencies would have been ineffective enough to prevent an electrical fire precipitating the crew being ejected from the ship.
Agreed. Happy hunting.
Captain, Starfleet Command has just ordered us to the Vorlis system. Admiral Donaldson would like us to escort a rescue party to one of its outer worlds.
Buck Wilmington's voice suddenly filled the air through Chris's comm badge. A rumble of disappointment rippled throughout the small room as it became apparent they would have to abandon their study of the Sulaco for the time being. This did not impress Chris at all. He wanted to go to Fury 361 on the dropship. Wynn was eager to fly and learn what had happened to Ellen Ripley and Hicks. Something took place after they ejected their EEV from the Sulaco, something that ensured no one left the planet alive except for one lone prisoner. It was vital for Chris to know, far more than playing ferryboat captain to the Forlì.
I see.
Chris frowned, not wanting to leave what he discovered here.
Shall I get Rain to transport you back to the ship?
Buck asked in anticipation of their return. Chris did not answer for a few seconds, letting his gaze move across the surrounding faces. Only Ezra seemed indifferent to staying behind, but this was his usual expression when dealing with any unknown situation. The others, however, looked as if they would be happy to remain behind, Julia in particular. It would not satisfy the chief engineer until she had stuck her finger in every nook and cranny in this old ship.
Stand by on that.
Captain.
Alex looked at him, forgetting herself as his science officer and facing him now as his second officer.
We should beam back to the Maverick.
As much as she would like to remain, the Sulaco would still be here when they returned from their mission to Forli. The ship had waited 4 centuries to be discovered. It could wait a few days until they returned.
I will beam back to the Maverick.
Chris looked at her sternly.
The rest of you stay here and carry out your orders.
Captain?
Chris shot Alex a glare that silenced her immediately.
This is not a democracy, Commander.
Of course not.
Carry out your orders.
Chris said crisply and tapped his comm badge lightly.
One to transport.
Are you out of your mind?
Buck stared at Chris from across the desk of the captain's ready room 5 minutes after Chris returned to the Maverick from the Sulaco. He suspected it might be difficult to pry the captain loose from the mystery of the ancient Earth ship, but he had not imagined just how determined Chris had become in such a short time. Worse yet, there was nothing untoward about what Chris had just suggested to him. It was a captain's prerogative. However, Buck's uneasiness about the Sulaco and Fury 361 made Chris's solution more than he could stomach.
I don't see the problem.
Chris eased back into his chair, watching Buck through his crisscrossed fingers.
You said it was a routine mission, 5 days at the most. I am confident you can handle things on your own for that time. The Sulaco is more than capable of sustaining an away team for 5 days, not to mention that I will have a runabout there in case we get into trouble.
Chris,
Buck protested, unconvinced this was wise. He did not like the idea of leaving the away team stranded on the Sulaco at all. There was just something about the ship that would not let him rest easy, no matter how illogical.
I don't think this is a good idea.
I think it is.
Chris insisted. Buck had no real reason to deny his desire to remain, not that he could sense Chris had complete autonomy on the decision. This discussion was ultimately at Chris's sufferance, and should he decide to end the argument, there was little Buck could do about it.
It's a rare find. We're uncovering so much about what happened there, and Hicks, is one of my ancestors. It's almost fate.
I don't believe in fate, and neither do you.
I used to think that.
Chris's gaze averted from Buck and shifted to the stars outside the window.
Not anymore. Something wants me to find the truth about that ship out there, something that waited for a long time for me to show up. I'm going to do just that. Too many things have been eluding me lately, and I won't stand for it any longer. I'm tired of secrets, Buck, and truths being hidden under supposedly plausible explanations. Those people on LV-427 died for nothing because someone felt they were less important than a life form promising corporate billions. So many dirty little lies hidden, so many lives destroyed because of someone with a secret agenda.
Buck stared at Chris for a long while, absorbing the captain's words. After an eternity that made even Chris impatient for a response, Buck finally spoke.
Are we talking about the Sulaco or Sarah and Adam?
Chris blinked.
The Sulaco, of course.
The captain answered just a little too quickly, and Buck knew he was lying. Suddenly, Buck realized what Chris was saying and what he had not. It made perfect sense once he understood.
It's not your fault you didn't know there was a conspiracy. No one had any reason to think Sarah and Adam's deaths were more than an accident. Hell, I never even considered it until Q dropped that bombshell on us.
Chris continued to stare at the surface of the desk. His hands had dropped to the edges, clenching the simulated wood in his fists.
I should have known. I should have known they were in danger. It was my job to protect my family. They died without me even having the slightest clue they were in danger. How could I be so blind? How can I run this ship if I could miss something as simple as that?
You were grieving for a wife and child. No one saw any signs of foul play. You had no reason to think you failed them. Chris, whoever did this to Sarah and Adam, was damned good. They've covered their tracks so well that it's almost a work of genius. You couldn't be expected to see through your state of mind. Hell, those who were thinking clearly didn't even see it.
I should have. I'm the captain of a starship. How can I be sure about anything if I was wrong about that?
Buck sighed in exasperation, aware of no words to assuage Chris's wounded confidence. He was right. A starship captain could not have doubts about anything. If he doubted himself, the problem Chris faced was a great deal worse than simply having an obsession with his wife and child's murder. It had to do with his ability to run the Maverick and be responsible for the 1,000 lives counting on him to keep them safe.
All right, Chris,
Buck conceded.
If you feel you have to do this, I'll take the ship on to Vorlis, but I will not leave you there alone. I am your first officer, and my duty to this ship also means my duty is to you. I won't give that up for anything. Do you understand?
Glad to be doing this with Buck's cooperation, Chris was not about to thumb his nose at any suggestions Buck may have regarding his personal safety. Besides, he agreed with the first officer. If they were to remain on the Sulaco, far from the safety of the Maverick, he would like adequate security, not only for himself but for the others who would stay behind him. As it was, Chris could already hear the demands Ezra would make once the security chief knew they would not be departing with the Maverick when it made the journey to Forlì.
I'll agree to that. Get a security team and supplies for the next 5 days, including phasers. I'll take one of our runabouts across to the Sulaco.
He pushed himself out of his chair to get moving.
Yes, Captain.
Buck nodded. He was still unhappy about this entire situation but had no choice but to agree. Chris had the power to veto his suggestions anyway, and the only way Buck could take it further was to question Chris's ability to command outright. It would have to be entered into the record, then followed by Buck relieving Chris of duty. As much as Buck worried and feared for his oldest friend, he was just not prepared to go that far. Yet. Things progressed rapidly after Chris decided to remain behind on the Sulaco. They stocked the runabout Pearlman with all the supplies required to stay on board the ancient ship while Julia restored the rest of the Sulaco's primary systems, beginning with the ship's living quarters. The ship's designers provided the Marines everything from beds to recreation rooms, amenities, and a mess hall. It was more than adequate for Starfleet officers whose survival training demanded far less. As expected, those staying behind were happy for a chance to study the ancient ship. Ezra, however, still voiced his concerns but was assuaged at being able to bring on board a security complement that included some of his best officers. After Julia powered the landing bay, Wynn took the Pearlman through the massive doors and set it down on the hangar deck. He was still eager to take the dropship for a flight but had to wait until Julia inspected the ship and ran a diagnostic on its systems. Captain's orders, she told Wynn, and though impatience gnawed at him, Wynn understood the need for caution. The last thing he wanted to do was be plunging miles into the stratosphere before discovering something was wrong with the ship. The Maverick remained as long as it could, delivering reports about Fiorina, Fury 361, showing that while the ionized atmosphere made precise sensor readings challenging to obtain, the planet continued to be uninhabited. While the facility remained intact for them to examine when they finally landed, there was nothing else of interest on Fury to cause a return journey once the Maverick was done with its investigations. Hopefully, 5 days would be enough to satisfy their curiosity.
Well, that's it. Everything's here.
Wynn said to Chris once they stored away the supplies, everyone was busily going about their given tasks. Alex continued her analysis of the recorder data while Julia was having the time of her life, inspecting the dropship, much to Wynn's delight, to make it fit for flight. Ezra and his security detail were roaming the large ship, ensuring no surprises were waiting for them, particularly in the living quarters they would occupy for the duration.
Good.
Chris nodded slowly, his gaze fixed on the small window allowing him to view the space outside the Sulaco. Wynn did not know whether it was the Maverick or Fiorina he was really looking at but guessed it did not really matter. Chris saw neither. It was easy to forget this was a personal quest for Chris even though the others were finding the Sulaco a historical curiosity. Wynn felt a little guilty about being so eager to fly a ship when his best friend was suffering all kinds of turmoil inside.
Chris, are you sure about this?
Chris looked up at that, his brow furrowed with confusion.
Yeah, why do you ask?
I don't know.
Wynn turned away, never comfortable discussing someone's feelings. It seemed doubly hard with Chris, even though they were so close.
Maybe you gave me the impression you were having second thoughts about this.
No.
Chris shook his head.
I have to find some truth for the people on this ship and those who died on LV-427. I've got to believe that there's justice somewhere.
Chris.
Wynn took a deep breath and hoped he didn't get thrown out of an airlock for speaking his mind.
Sometimes things happen because they just do, and we must accept it. Maybe you're so ready to believe Q because, after all this time, you're not ready to accept your family is gone. Oh, you know they've passed on in your head, but not really in your heart.
Chris swallowed and considered Wynn's words, wondering if, on some level, the Vulcan was right. He was not ready to let Sarah and Adam go, not just yet. It didn't matter, Chris told himself defiantly. Until he knew the truth, nothing else did.